In this specially extended episode, we're joined by Jazznet Samurai and Adam, co-creator of Derby Against Hate.
Brexit means Brexit.
An exit from Brexit.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Seamus and not sure this is a great idea, is it?
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Debated Podcast. I'm Will, I'm one of the co-hosts, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host Conrad.
Hello.
And this week's guest is...
Oh, hi, I'm Jazz, and I'm from the Liberal Democrats, and I am a member of the South East Executive for the party.
Right, well, let's get started. To begin with, I'd like to ask, what are your sort of like general feelings about the recent Conservative leadership contest? How do you think it's going? What do you think each of the candidates will potentially offer the future of the country?
I mean, obviously, I don't think either of the two candidates, the Dems, especially when it comes to like their Brexit stances and things like that, I find that I can disagree with them. However, I much prefer obviously Jeremy Hunt to Boris Johnson, but in my view, neither of them are fit to be Prime Minister. So I just think the Tory leadership contest has taken such a turn, and it's a real shame, to be honest. There are so many good Tory MPs, and it's just a shame, you know, the ones that we're left with, it's a bit sad.
Out of the Tory MPs, you said there's so many good ones. Who would you have, out of the whole parliamentary Conservative Party, ideally have liked to see?
Oh, ideally as leader? There was fair few for Justine Greening, I think, would make a really good leader. I think Chloe Smith would make a good leader. You know, there are lots of moderate Tory MPs out there. You know, I could name about 10 or 15 off the top of my head, but I just think that there is so much talent within that parliamentary party. And I feel like with the candidates that have been put, or even with, say, the candidate who originally stood for this group, I do think that it is a shame to kind of, you know, watch the Tory party take a real turn to the right. And I think that's really dangerous for the country. So I don't necessarily think any of the candidates were representative of what the country wants. And that to me is just a shame, and it's where democracy is kind of failing in a way.
Obviously, one of the most important issues regarding the Conservative leadership contest is Brexit. And I know that you're obviously passionately campaigned against it. Do you think that there is a way that either of the candidates can in any sense bridge the divide between leavers and remainers? Or do you think that this is going to be something going forward that is going to dominate our politics for a long time, the sort of the divide between leave and remain?
So I think originally when the Brexit vote happened, I think it could have been bridged. Say, you know, Theresa May's deal or her, the deal that she wanted to put through. I do think that deal could have potentially bridged the country because it was a middle ground. And I think the solution to Brexit, and that's, this is going to be an unpopular thing to say, if we don't have, but I do think that the only way to truly bridge the country around the issue of Brexit is to have some sort of middle ground, something like a common market 2.0, which is actually something that's advocated for privately within our party. So I think that in order to bridge the country, we need a middle deal. However, I can't see that happening in the next few months because any attempt of finding a middle ground has just been rejected. And just the math isn't there. Nothing, it's not possible to achieve. So for me personally, I do think that a hard leave would be detrimental to our society, which is why I do firmly back to Remain now. Because I just think that, you know, sacrificing people's livelihoods isn't the way to go. And the reasons that people voted to leave weren't necessarily due to the EU, they were due to other factors. And I think now the government's goal should ultimately be to have another vote, so and hopefully that will, you know, indicate where public mood is, and if public mood still suggests that they want Brexit to happen, then Brexit should happen. But I do think that lots of factors come to light since the referendum, and obviously if you look at the business now compared to the referendum, and so I do think we need another vote, and after that I do need to work on, say, bridging our communities and working on solutions and, you know, funding projects and putting an end to austerity and things like that as well.
Do you think that any of the conservative leadership candidates outside of Brexit policies have any ideas that you've thought are quite good, or do you think that they're not saying enough out of their domestic policies?
Yeah, that's my issue. I feel like the news, well, I'm not an expert on the Conservative Leadership Contest. I've obviously been really, really heavily involved in our internal one, so I haven't had that much time to listen to most candidates. All I hear is what's been on the news and the big soundbites today. So for me, and I think this is how a large portion of the public feel too, is that the only things that I've really heard about the candidates are their Brexit stances, maybe like a few little nitty-picky domestic issues, but nothing of substance. And then obviously, you know, media things that are going on, so obviously Boris Johnson has been in the media a lot. But for me personally, I feel like there is a big hole that we're missing in British politics at the moment. It's not just the Conservative leadership, it's everything. But I feel like we're ignoring domestic issues and instead focusing too much on Brexit. Because there are so many issues at home that we should be dealing with that we're not.
And as you say, that there does seem to be sort of like a fight for the centre ground of politics. I mean, Boris Johnson in a recent interview said that he wanted to be a prime minister from the centre right. Rory Stewart said during the leadership contest that he wanted to revive the centre. Do you think that after years of being told that sort of the centre of politics and centrist politics are dead, do you think we're beginning to see a revival of the centre, or do you think that this is all just sort of like show and this won't be backed up by policies that might be seen as centrist?
So I think politics has become incredibly polarised after the last, you know, over the last decade. We've seen the rise of the far left, we've seen the rise of the far right, and I do think that it's natural to come back into the centre, and I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a new political alignment. Saying returning to the centre is a pretty vague term. And I do also think that not only are we seeing a return to the centre, I feel like we're seeing almost a return to, say, like liberal politics as well. I do think there's been a revival almost of liberalism. And I feel like that's an element of it coming back into the centre. Well, I think saying, I do think we've been returning to the centre, but I also think that's just pretty vague, as in, like, what counts as the centre? You know, there's lots of opinion on that.
So we've talked about the Conservative leadership contest, but obviously your party, the Lib Dems, has a leadership contest going on as well at the moment. Probably not as high profile, but you know, it's still going on. So who are you backing to be the next Lib Dem leader, and why do you think they're better than the other candidates?
I'm Ed Davey, and for me personally, both of them are good candidates. For me, Ed is the person who, you know, makes me want to get out of my seat and campaign, and he's, I personally believe, the only candidate who can truly provide direction for our party to head in, because he has, you know, some solid, really solid proposals. It's not, for me, Ed isn't just soundbites. He's a genuine politician who has, you know, who cares about everyone. And I've seen this because obviously I'm based in Kent, so I'm really close to the London Party, the party that Ed represents and is really heavily involved in. And I've watched him encourage candidates to come forward. I've watched him, you know, tackle internal issues. I've watched him campaign for his constituents. So for me, you know, it's not just words, it's actions as well. Yeah, and he's really inspired me personally.
I wondered, as you said that you're supporting Ed Davey, what you thought about a recent piece that he wrote for The Times, in which he said that he floated the idea of a Remain alliance to decapitate that blonde head in Uxbridge and South Ruislip. Do you think that he was mistaken in using language like that to describe Boris Johnson?
So I do think so. For me personally, I don't think it's a problem just with Ed. I think it's a problem again with politics as a whole. And I keep saying, I constantly say it everywhere I go, I do feel like politics has taken a really bitter turn recently. To the point where the language that is used to describe politicians has just is completely unacceptable. And I do think that's really, really dangerous. And I think it's not just Ed, again, it's all MPs, you know, or not all MPs, but you know, I've seen a wide from a wide spectrum of parties. So I do think it's just a problem that needs to be tackled, and we need to tackle this toxic culture that is prevalent within our politics at the moment. Because it's just really negative, and I don't think politics should be negative. Politics should be about change and debate. It doesn't have to have this negative element to it.
Do you think the negative sort of element in politics is sort of putting off sort of younger people from getting involved?
Definitely, because if you look at young people and you know what they stand for. So a bit of background on me: I used to be the youth chair for the South East region. So you know, I work with young people really closely, and I still do now. And for me, I feel like young people are really opinionated. They're really passionate. We might not agree on everything, like in terms of like young people, there's lots of debate within young people, but I do think that you know, this discourse, this negative discourse, is really pushing young people off politics, because but having an inclusive environment is so important, and I just don't see that happening. And whilst it's obviously prominent with young people, if you even look at the public in general, I just feel like we're in such a dire time, and politics is becoming this kind of exclusive thing that isn't really relevant, and the whole idea of, you know, abuse, toxic discourse, whatever, it's kind of pushing it into another box and making it completely separate from reality. Politics isn't representative of reality. There's a massive, massive divide at the moment, and we need to work on fixing that and building trust. And what this toxic behaviour is doing, and these toxic terms, and these, you know, just abuse that lots of people in politics get, you know, idea that politics is a game. All it's doing is dividing that, and it's separating the two. And what it's doing is it's stopping people from feeling like they can get involved.
You wrote a piece recently, January this year, entitled "Arg, I Hate Politics," and and in the piece you argue, in the piece you argued that part of the reason the problem with youth participation is because the system that politics relies on, the structure of politics, is somewhat set against young people. How do you think we can change that to make it more accessible to young people and make sure that they aren't put off from taking part in politics?
So I spoke about, again, the issue of abuse briefly in that piece, and I feel like I've kind of outlined as to how, you know, we can be, how political parties as a whole, not just my party, but everyone needs to be more inclusive of young people. But in terms of accessibility, things like going to events and where events are held and things like that, to say me, there are times where I've spent, you know, £50-60 in one day going to an event. Because, you know, I, as an elected person, I obviously have to represent, so obviously I've come from a local background as well, so I've had to represent, say, my local area or my local youth division, so I've had to go to events and I've had to spend my money. And as a young person, you know, that's really hard because you don't get that much money. And to be spending £60-70 in a day, and that's just on travel, and that's not even including accommodation, for me, that's, you know, a lot of money, and that's something that lots of young people can't do. So again, it's the idea that politics is only available for a certain type of person, a certain type of elitist. And for me, like, I'm not the poshest person. I come from a working class background. I go to state school, even though I got into grammar school, which I'm really lucky and grateful for that. But, you know, in order to do these things, I have to sacrifice a lot. Like, I don't really go out that much with my friends, and money on is very, very different to my peers. So for me personally, I think, you know, politics needs to become more affordable, and political parties can do that by, you know, providing subsidies and things to young people and making events cheaper. So there are times where I've sat in meetings for party events, and it will be like, you know, if you have a formal dinner with MPs and stuff, and they'll charge £200 a ticket, and I'm thinking, what young person would can afford £200 a ticket?
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I barely earn that in a month. That, you know, that disconnect again between people in power and young people is humongous, and it needs to be bridged.
You know, I definitely think agree with your broad point about young people in politics and things being too expensive. I've found that in the Conservative Party, that there are a lot of events and you think, is that worth it, you know, when I, you know, for what I'm paying, for what I'm getting out of that. You know, it's all very well for like a wealthy pensioner to be paying that money, but it's a bit different for like a student who's, you know, making ends meet. Yeah. But play devil's advocate a little bit. Do you think that sort of obviously all parties are kind of strapped for money, they've got a load of campaigns going on, elections happening all the time, that they can't really afford to subsidise like sort of younger students and younger people because they've got so much else that they've got going on?
Yeah, but it's a matter of priority. So for me, I see getting young people to events as almost as a thing that should happen, because ultimately, if you don't get young people to events, what happens is, A, decisions are made by, you know, the older generation. Young people don't get a say in the world that affects them and internal party politics. And for me, that really saddens me, because I just feel like young people don't have a voice, and even in society in general, they don't really have a voice. And if you're going to, again, keep them further away from the procedures that make change, that's an issue. And then also, if you look at things like, you know, getting young people to events, what you're doing is, if it's a training day or something, you're, you know, you're investing in the future of the party too. If we can get young people trained, if we can give them the skills that they need, hopefully we'll, you know, bring down the average age of our parliamentary party. Hopefully we'll, you know, have these skills, and we'll have these new campaigners who can actually, you know, revive their parties in down the line. You know, you're investing in a person. By subsidising eventual, you're giving people the skills that they need. And political parties should see that that's a benefit, because what they end up with is more skilled campaigners and activists. So it's mutual benefit. And I really don't understand why parties don't invest money into young people. Like, to me, it doesn't make sense. I understand that they're stripped for cash, and I understand that obviously elections are expensive and targeting is expensive and leaflets are expensive and, you know, everything is really expensive, but I just think there are things that parties spend money on that don't need to be spent money on, if you get what I'm saying. Like, I just, there are times when money is spent and decisions are made, and I think, why are you spending this much money on this? Like, as an example, within my party, there was a campaigner who dedicated thousands of pounds, I'm not going to say how much, but thousands of pounds, to creating an app for conference. This app never got created, and this money just got threw down the drain. And I was thinking, you could have spent that on useful things.
Yeah. Just moving on slightly, the Brecon and Radnorshire by-election is coming up, and it looks like it could be a close contest between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. What do you think are the chances of the Lib Dems taking that seat from the Conservatives?
So I do think that we could win it. I think it, you know, it's one of our most winnable seats in Wales. I do think there is a good chance that we win it. Obviously, the circumstances around the by-election aren't the best for the Tories as well. So I do think that we have an ad factor there. Also, you know, we have the largest membership we ever have had. And obviously, because it's the only by-election at the moment in terms of parliamentary by-election, we will have constant activists visiting that area, you know, doing walks, campaigning. And it's a chance to really get the candidate Jane Dodds has in that community and getting to know the issues there. I've been following her closely. I love her Instagram. I try to stalk that. I know that a lot of work has gone there, and also obviously we have Kirsty Williams there as well, who's currently the AM for that area, a member of the Senate. So I do think there's a really good chance that we can win that seat, and I feel like after the European elections, we as a party have that momentum to win that seat. And for me, that's really exciting. I do think my chances are good.
Obviously, the Brexit Party have also said that they're going to stand a candidate in the by-election. It's an area that they've done quite well in the European elections. What are your thoughts on sort of the threat posed by the Brexit Party and their impact on politics more generally?
So, for me, I think the Brexit Party were actually somewhat inevitable. And my reasoning for that is politics, again, has become extremely polarised over Brexit. The Conservatives and the Labour Party are failing to appeal to the proportion of the population that is, you know, a hard Brexit supporting. And that's a feeling that has, you know, existed for a long time. The area that I live in, Rochester and Shrewsbury, the constituency that I live in, it's an ex-UKIP constituency. It's a very hard Leave constituency. And I remember in 2017, even in local elections, we had that feeling of, neither of the main two parties are, you know, standing up for what I believe in. And whether I agree with that or not, it's clear that there is a disillusionment between the public and the two main parties at the moment. So I do think that something had to fill that, again, hole in British politics, and the Brexit Party obviously did. And do they pose a threat? Well, I mean, I feel like that's a big question. If you look at the MEP elections, for example, they did incredibly well. Maybe not as well as they'd like, but they did do well. And I do think they pose a threat in terms of winning seats. It's perfectly possible that they win seats. I mean, if you look at areas of the country where, to say my constituency, for example, the Brexit Party got something like 30,000 votes, whereas we came second and we got 8,000. So again, that clear majority for the Brexit Party shows that, yeah, they probably do pose a threat in individual constituencies. And if there was a general call and they had 650 candidates, there would be a good chance that they'd get, you know, a good few seats. I mean, by a few, I mean probably about dozens.
Yeah.
So for me personally, I think they are a threat, but I do think they're a short-term threat. It's a single-issue party. Whatever happens in Brexit, if there's a hard Brexit, well, the Brexit Party will go away. If there's a second referendum, you know, the Brexit Party and Remain win, the Brexit Party will go away. So I think in the long term, I don't think they're a threat. I just think for now, they're a symbol of how volatile politics is as a whole.
We're coming to the end of the podcast now, and I've got one final question for you, Jazz. If you were stuck on a desert island and you could have only one luxury item with you, what would it be?
That's a big question. Wasn't expecting that. I don't really know, to be honest. What counts as a luxury item?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know, a life supply of chocolate, a particular book, something like that. Is there anything in particular that comes to mind, or?
It's actually a really hard question. I'm just thinking on the spot now. You've got me. I didn't think this was the one that was going to get me. I don't really know, to be honest. I think I'd probably take... Again, you mentioned a book, and there was a book that came to mind. The book that came to mind was We Were Liars by Emily Lockhart.
Uh-huh.
By the way, it's a brilliant read. I would highly suggest you read it. It's not political related at all as well, so good escapism there. But basically, it's one of those books that, you know, like really motivate me to get up and make change. And it doesn't, it's one of those books about, you know, it's a fictional book, but it's kind of a sort of autobiographical thing based on real events. But for me, I think that would be the book that I choose, because it would just encourage me to carry on. I feel like a desert island would be really boring, and I'd just be stuck in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, I just need hope, and I just need something to, like, cling on to and be like, yeah, it could get worse. My house could get on fire. So...
So, welcome to the podcast, Adam. It's great to have you on. Do you think, to begin with, you could explain what's been happening in Derby North and what the sort of the general situation is for anyone who doesn't know?
Sure. So the situation in Derby North is a bit complicated and is in flux. So what we're saying now might not be true by the time this goes live. But essentially what happened was over a period of time in the MP for Derby North, Chris Williamson, who was a Labour MP, now is a Labour MP and may no longer be a Labour MP in the next couple of weeks. He gaslit Jews for a considerable number of considerable amount of time. He retweeted or was associated with out and out anti-Semites, including people who had like questioned the numbers who had died in the Holocaust, or who had even questioned whether or not the Holocaust had happened itself. And this all boiled up until about February this year, when Chris Williamson, at a meeting of Sheffield Momentum, said to rapturous applause that the Labour Party had been too apologetic on the issue of anti-Semitism. That, after a while, and after a half apology from Chris Williamson, got himself suspended, until two members of a three-member panel voted to re-accept Chris Williamson into the party. That was met quite sensibly with a wide degree of scorn and outrage from the entire party, left, centre, and the right wing of the party. And it is looking like that is going to get overturned in the next couple of weeks by the full NEC. What that means for Chris, we are yet to find out, whether that will be he gets suspended for a year or 6 months, or is forced to go on some kind of re-education program in order to then be readmitted into the party, is unclear, and how much he is able to learn from that is also unclear, because he's already had meetings with representatives of the Jewish communities that are involved in the Labour Party with not much success. So I'm personally sceptical about his ability to understand what he's done wrong, but it will be interesting to see where we move forwards.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, you're the co-founder of Derby Against Hate. What would you say is the aim of your campaign? And is it just to deal with the problems arising from Chris Williamson, or does it have a broader range of activities and a broader agenda?
So, yeah, that's a really good question. We founded a Twitter account which is at NoHateInDerby, or Derby Against Hate, in the wake of the news about Chris Williamson, because we were just fed up with the amount of racism and anti-Semitism and other forms of intolerance within Derby as a city, and also more specifically to do with the Labour Party within Derby. And we were really disappointed to see the result of the NEC three panel meeting. And that was kind of like the impetus for us to set this up. But we also have in our city more UKIP councillors now than we did in 2016. We gained two UKIP councillors in the election just locally in the 2019 local elections, and we had two elected in 2018 as well. In 2020, so next year, we're likely, if we don't do anything about it, to see another two or three UKIP councillors be elected. And that needs a bigger conversation as well. But the only way we're ever going to be able to deal with that problem is if we get our own house in order first.
So why do you think there is such a great deal of anti-Semitism on the left, and in particular in the Labour Party? What do you think is the root cause of it?
I don't know. I mean, it's a big question that I think better people than me are placed to answer, particularly people who are Jewish themselves or have studied this academically. I would imagine that there is just a great deal of ignorance about anti-Semitism, what is and isn't anti-Semitic, what is and isn't gaslighting for Jews, what is and isn't just really offensive or not willing to say. I think people get very defensive about their idols. So Chris Williamson is obviously a very long-standing member of the left within Derby, and he is adored by a lot of people who see him as a leading light, a true socialist and that kind of thing. And he is well liked by a lot of people. So I think people rush to defend him because they think, oh, well, Chris Williamson has never done anything wrong to me, and he's always been a supporter of the causes I believe in. So therefore, I can't possibly believe that Jewish people would be offended by what he's been saying. So I think there is a reluctance to deal with the problem of anti-Semitism when it's people that you like engaging with anti-Semitic ideas or people. But I think that generally, I can't really say an answer more specifically than that about why there is a large amount of anti-Semitism on the left.
How do you think the Labour Party can tackle anti-Semitism more effectively?
So again, Jewish organisations can answer this more specifically, but generally we just need to massively overhaul our disciplinary procedures. They are an absolute joke. They need to be made independent. They need to be taken out of the control of a group of people on the NCC or the NEC, and they need to be much more transparent. They need to happen a lot more quickly, and they have to actually like inform the people who are involved. So Chris Williamson tweeted the other day, and I have no reason to not believe him, that he still hasn't heard from the NEC or the NCC what the resolution to his case actually was. So he is still in the dark about what happened. There was no like press release or anything that I've seen from the committee that said what happened. It was just somebody told a reporter who wrote for Political Home, who then put it on their website. This isn't how like we should be dealing with our disciplinary cases. It should be transparent, it should be independent, and it should be efficient. And I really hope that conference this year takes up some kind of amendment in order to make that happen, because that should apply to sexual harassment, that should apply to anti-Semitism, racism, homophobia, and all of these problems are in the Labour Party. If the Labour Party has 500,000 members or whatever it is, we are going to have some of those people who are either sexist or racist or homophobic. It's a part of being an organisation this big. The way you get around that is by having an independent process that deals with it when it happens. And until that is in place, I don't think anyone will have any faith in the disciplinary process of the Labour Party.
We talked about this on the podcast in the last episode when we spoke to Daniel Sugarman, and we talked about it a couple of weeks before when we talked to George Ayler. And I think it's interesting what you say about ensuring that something has to go forward at conference. Do you think that the only way that this can be really, really dealt with is if there is a change to the rules of the Labour Party that make it easier to deal with this sort of abuse?
I don't know. I know that the Labour Party passed an amendment which ruled out any kind of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia or any form of racism a while ago, and it'll be interesting to see if that is enough or if new rule changes need to happen. I think it's more about the fact that the process needs to be transparent, it needs to happen faster, and it needs to be independent. I think you probably wouldn't need to change that many rules in order to set up, but better people than me will be able to explain more specifically about what should happen in terms of Labour Party rules.
Do you think that this and the other cases of anti-Semitism have somewhat tarnished the Labour Party's image?
Of course it has. Having anti-Semites in our party and having people who are friends with anti-Semites in our party is obviously going to tarnish our image, not only with the Jewish community, but with the wider public as a whole, and just any kind of like ordinary person who doesn't like racism is going to think badly of the Labour Party because of the number of anti-Semites that we've still got in our party.
So what do you think if Chris Williamson does end up finally leaving the Labour Party, what do you think will be the lasting impact of that?
I think you'll have left the Derby Labour Party in a much weaker position to fight UKIP, fight the Tories and fight the Lib Dems. I would say that in 2018, one of the reasons why we went backwards rather than forwards was because, and lost control of the party, was because of his actions and what he was saying. And I think that it will take quite a long time for the new MP for Derby North to regain trust within the communities here in order to say the Labour Party has dealt with Chris Williamson and his problematic statements and beliefs, and we are moving forwards in a way that is inclusive of everybody. And hopefully, once that new MP or new candidate is in place, we will be able to regain control of Derby City Council in order to get rid of the UKIP councillors, get rid of the Lib Dems who have been tolerating the UKIP presence and working with them to keep the Tory administration in power. Because at the end of the day, it isn't just a problem about UKIP being on the council. They could they could have four councillors in zero power, but they have power because they're propped up by the Lib Dems and by the Tories, both of which are collaborating with UKIP to keep Labour out of office. So after, if Chris Williamson does get kicked out of the party or resigns or is deselected, then hopefully we'll be able to rebuild and then concentrate on fighting the hatred from UKIP that we see in our city.
Finally, where are there any petitions or letters that people can sign encouraging the Labour Party to reverse this decision? I mean, obviously there's your Twitter account that people can follow. What other methods are there that people can support a change in the decision?
Yeah, so there are plenty of different letters from different groups of people floating around on Twitter that anybody can find probably just by searching Chris Williamson in a letter. But the key things that I think that we need people to be doing at the moment is, first of all, they need to write to their NEC representatives on the NEC and ask them, especially the members who are involved in the decision, they need to be asked, why did they decide that in that way? So if you're a BME person in particular, then write to Keith Vaz because he is your representative, but then also write to the nine or maybe eight, don't write to Peter Walsman, he's probably not going to help you, but write to the eight CLP reps and ask them where they stand on Chris Williamson. Do they think Chris Williamson should remain suspended? Do they think that Chris Williamson should be kicked out of the Labour Party, and when should that happen? The second thing people should do if they have a Labour MP is make sure their Labour MP has signed the Labour Party letter, Labour MP's letter, sorry, that is going around, including making sure they'll vote to suspend Chris Williamson from the Parliamentary Labour Party, because even if he is re-admitted into the Labour Party, he can still be suspended by the PLP within Parliament, which will be at least a step in the right direction. And then thirdly, they need to either email us or contact us on Twitter, especially if they live within Derby and Derby North in particular, or have any friends that do so, because we're trying to organise as many people who are against all forms of racism and intolerance in order to move forwards with our campaign, both in the first instance against Chris and moving towards deselection for him, but also with regards to fighting UKIP and fighting the Lib Dems and Tories who have collaborated with UKIP moving forwards.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast, Adam. It's been great to have you on, and I wish you all the highest amount of success with your campaign.
No problem. Thank you.
If you would like to get in touch with us, you can email us at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Debated Podcast, like our Facebook page, and hopefully stick around for the next episode.